Everybody's trying to take a GPT LLM and stick it somewhere in the product. Are you solving a real problem or just trying to be cool and get on the hype train? One of the cool things that we did, for example, is explain a command line. So we've introduced that into product and our customers went like insane.
Who says tech can't be human?
What's going on, Hacker Valley fam? Welcome back to the show. I had the opportunity to meet someone really cool, really special in the space of cybersecurity. And I say really cool, really special because I feel like they have a little bit of a similar journey that I do, moving from security research to really focusing on developing products and introducing and ushering in the next wave of cybersecurity solutions. My guest this episode is Ofer Geyer. Ofer is VP of Product at Hunters, and he's here to also talk a lot about product management and what it's like to build great solutions in the world of cybersecurity. Most importantly, Ofer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ron.
Yes, thank you for being here. We had a great scoping call where we got to just learn more about each other, but it was probably more so me asking you questions about yourself. So let's start with the easy stuff, right? Maybe this is also the hard question to answer because you got to speak about yourself. But, you know, I mentioned security research. You started your career as a security researcher. Let's start there. Tell us a little bit about what led you into security research and some of the, you know, great things that happened along the way.
Yeah, so it was an interesting, you know, career path. I was doing cybersecurity work more maybe on the offensive side for a few years in intelligence. And when I finished my service, I was honestly kind of shotgunning around, like because I wasn't like a developer. I wasn't writing code. And I felt like I was kind of a jack of all trades, which is, it's cool when you know, there's a mission you need to do that. But when you go to the business world, you need to find like, what's the best thing that I can get paid for, I like to do, offer some sort of challenge and a career path. So I was looking at different types of positions. And I was introduced to a company called Encapsula at the time. And we talked about different solutions. I was thinking maybe I do like solution engineering, type of like a pre-sale, post-sale position, because I really like, you know, solutioning and thinking and working on some things. And then the hiring manager said, well, have you thought about security research? I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. But I didn't think like that's what you want to offer. He's like, no, that's something that we have a position for. Okay, cool. What do I need to do? So, well, let's talk. And then, okay, there's this home assignment that we do. You think you can do it? I was like, I'll give it my best shot. And it was to bypass some of the features that Encapsula developed at the time. Was something to do with like a JavaScript anti-bot thing. And the challenge was to bypass it. I was not a web application expert at the time at all. I was doing more networking and things like that, you know. And I didn't really write a lot of Python, but I really wanted the job. So I sat down and I said, okay, how do you do this in Python? How do I like do a GET request? Okay, what does this do? Okay, it's obfuscated JavaScript. So I just spent probably 4 or 5 days straight, maybe a week, just brute forcing through like, how do I get this done? And updating the hiring manager. And I was like, okay, I think I'm done. I was like, really? Yeah, cool. And then I talked to a couple more people, and that was my first research job, you know. And I felt like, oh, this is this, you know, it paid well, but it's also super exciting. If this is the kind of stuff I can get to do every day, that's really cool. And I was lucky enough. I joined the company, 30 some people. I was the second researcher guy. I had a lot of great people that really took the time to show me the ropes. So that was amazing.
And Encapsula was ultimately acquired, right?
Yeah. So Encapsula is an interesting company. It was kind of a spin-off from Imperva. Imperva is like originally and a very on-prem company, really selling boxes, you know, one of the pioneers of cybersecurity in Israel, definitely in web application firewalls. And Encapsula, started by one of the founders, Gore, was one of the seniors at Imperva, and they spun it off as a cloud service. You know, when cloud security was kind of like this dream, a similar story and similar time and similar path to a Cloudflare that a lot of people know today. We're a more security company, a bit more, I want to say, SMB enterprise, and they were more like SMB down, free, more of the CDN company. But yeah, very, very cool. Spun off, I think it was, a lot of it was funded by Imperva. And then when they saw, okay, the bet paid off, they just acquired, you know, the last few percentages of the company.
So it was spun out of Imperva and then bought by Imperva.
Something like that. Again, I'm not one of the founders, but that's the story I've been told. It was mostly owned by Imperva, and then they bought it back once they saw it successful. And, you know, it was the new growth engine Imperva for many, many years.
I see the same thing happen to Palo Alto Networks. I used to work there. I used to work for an Israeli, you know, founded startup called Demisto. And then Palo Alto Networks acquired Demisto. And then, you know, I seen people leave and then come right back because, you know, it's all about getting that growth opportunity and being able to push forward. And I think it's a lot easier to like do that with a small team, especially in security, versus trying to spin up a product internally.
Yeah, and I think what helps like company like Palo Alto really stay, you know, ahead of the pack and leading the industry is I think a lot of people stay there for a long time. You know, Nir Zuk, I remember seeing him when I was, you know, very, very young, in the first year that I think he started Palo Alto, and talking to a very small room, and still, I think he still speaks with the same, you know, zeal and the same kind of conviction. Yeah. And companies like Imperva, you know, in the time that I was there, 6 years, I think we changed like 4 CEOs. That really kind of chips away at the company core and conviction, becomes a lot of, you know, bean counters and movers, and how do we get the numbers for the private equity? And it loses kind of that capability to keep people in and drive forward.
Right. You know, when I think back about my time as a security researcher, I used to be a security researcher for McAfee and more or less for Intel Corporation as well. I miss it. I miss just being able to like freely wander the web, especially freely wander Reddit, see what's out there, try a bunch of open source solutions, try to break, you know, our solution. I used to break, see what could get around and bypass McAfee when that was kind of like the leading AV company. But, you know, I do enjoy what I do now. Like there's parts that I miss, but there's definitely parts that I enjoy better without. How's it been for you? Like, what was that thing that you enjoyed the most? And was there anything in security research that said, I'm kind of tired with this, I'm going to try something new out?
I love security research, and I still, to a fault, get interested in some things. You know, it's very hard to keep up when you're not hands-on. You know, when I started, you know, again, cloud security was in its, you know, infancy, and then now there's all sorts of like attack surfaces and things change. Everything is a lot of like API security, which kind of like this was this vision many years ago. But I still care about it. And I think, you know, what you like the most, I guess, is, you know, beating the bad guys, or even better, to be honest and a little blunt, screwing with the bad guys. You know, when you do a lot of these things, sometimes it's like, oh, there's this big, you know, attack group and threat actor. And sometimes it's more like hand-to-hand combat. You know, there's this one customer that, you know, really get someone on them, and it's like, I'm going to beat them. And you find something and it works, and you stay ahead, and you're able to get the upper hand, at least for a while, because that's the game that we play, the kind of Red Queen's race. But that's really good, you know, when you were able to kind of get the upper hand. I remember, you know, everybody's heard the thing about the Mirai botnet that, you know, took down so many of the internet back then. And a lot of people don't know, they're not in the industry, maybe, took down a lot of DDoS mitigation providers because it was almost an order of magnitude more than a lot of vendors were ready for, you know. I was very, very proud, and we were able to kind of see it very early on, regroup, go back to the drawing board, re-architect our stuff. And then it, like, we were too powerful and too scalable for them to take us down. It's like, oh, you know, I'm, you know, it's like Rocky kind of thing. It's a very cool moment.
So I've always wanted to be more hands-on with product. You know, the closest that I got was working in customer success, which, mm-hmm. you know, when you hear that term, you hear that title, you don't think that it could be a technical role. But I look at it as like, you're the one that goes in, boots on the ground after someone buys the product. And that's when someone, you know, your customer is most vulnerable. They just made a huge investment. Like, let's be honest, cybersecurity products cost a lot of money, and they're going to need to show some value to their stakeholders and maybe even their C-suite executives. And I will look at the same as product management, but even more intimate with the customer and the company that you work for. What were some of the surprises or some of the opportunities or challenges that you've seen when you first got into product management at a new company?
Yeah, I think it's something that people ask me often, and I talk to my team, especially, you know, I had some people on my team that also transitioned. One of my product managers also transitioned from research at Hunters to product at my team. And it seems that in recent years, and maybe it's my perception, but I hear that a lot of people agree with that. A lot of people want to be product managers. It seems, I don't know, a good job, a respected job, maybe even like a sexy kind of thing. And I think, I'm not saying that it's not, but I think there's like the external perception and the reality, right? The external perception of product management is, oh, I get to decide what we do. I have a lot of good ideas. I'm sure I'll be a good PM, right? Because I really know. And I think the challenge is not necessarily having good ideas. It comes down to communication and prioritization. Communication is, how do I convey different things? How do I understand what that person is telling me? And how do I talk to them and get the closer to the truth? I talk to a customer. He says, well, I have this problem. You know, you can, worst case is you ignore him. And then you can just take what they say verbatim and then move it, you know, like copy paste. Okay, the customer said that X. What you want to do is like, okay, why is that bothering you? What are you trying to achieve? What does that mean for you? Is this causing a trouble with your stakeholders inside your company? What does that mean for you? You're my champion inside the organization. Why do you need this? How does this affect your business? And then you can be more creative and offer different things. So translating the same thing from engineering. So engineering says that this is the problem. How does that translate into, you know, business things and vice versa? And then prioritization. And prioritization is not what we do next that I think is cool, because there's a lot of things. The hardest problem, I think, is out of all the amazing things that I want to do and I need to do sometimes, what do I do first? It's not what's good and what's bad. It's all the things I really want to achieve. How do I prioritize within that? How do I make the hard decisions? How do I see everything shifting together and what's going to give me the best bang for the buck, build a sustainable business? And that can be really, really hard, especially when you're a startup. When you're a big company, you can make a lot of bets. Startups, you make bets, but you need to be careful with making bets. You can have most of them not pay off. You're not a venture capital. You need to be a bit more calculated with what you're putting your chips on.
If I were to go into product management, I think that I would have a hard time towing the line of not being engineering. Because like, when I think of product management, I think of having control and like, oh, I see this slight thing that needs to be fixed. Let me try to go in and fix it. And maybe that's not the best use of my time. I'm sure that maybe, I would imagine, coming from a security research background, that you might have had to toe that line and get organized, and probably leading teams, you've had to, you know, coach people Is that something that you see, like people wanting to apply changes to the product directly in product management?
Of course, of course. I had the same problem. You know, you set yourself up. What you do as a technical hands-on engineering person, what you want to be the go-to guy, right? You want to be that person when someone has a hard problem. You want to be that person that kind of knows how to do something, and you want to know the product inside and out. Well, that becomes a problem because that's your muscle memory, right? Mm. Oh, I can just go in. I still have my credentials, still have my privileges. I can go in and just fix it myself. Creates a lot of problems. Hey, this is not what you get paid to do now. You should be investing your time. So let's say, well, I'm not doing that. I'm doing this like at 2 a.m. because I'm bored and this is what I like to do. Cool. But you're also not educating other people, and you're building bad processes. What happens when you don't have the time? You haven't, you know, built the organization to operate in your absence and not doing it. You need to let go, and you need to focus your energy on the things that you're required to do now. So it was very hard for me. I think it took me more than 6 months to delete. I actually deleted Python from my laptop. I deleted a lot of things, and I had IT remove my credentials. I don't want access to production environment. I don't want all these privileges. I can't. If even anybody asks it, I can't do it. If I want to do it, I can't. I have to put these obstacles in because I need to force myself. And I see that, you know, sometimes with my folks, I have one person on my team. He came, he was senior director of engineering, and he wanted to do product. Another person I mentioned, he was a research team lead. They're very, very technical, highly skilled technical people. These are not, you know, just random engineers. They're very, you know, top of the game. And I think with them, they don't necessarily have the credentials, but it's also about, guys, remember, you can have an opinion about the solution. Your job is to focus on what is the problem, your problem space. That's 80% of where you should be focusing your energy. And then when you agree, you articulate the problem that we're trying to solve to engineering, you know, really, really well, and you all agree and you get the consensus. You want to talk to them about, you know, are we doing this with, you know, this infrastructure or that library, or should we use this or that? Cool. You should know the technology. You shouldn't be blind to it. That's gravy. You know, have, you know, strong opinions, held them loosely. Engineering calls the shots. You won't want engineers to call the business shots. You shouldn't be calling the engineering shots. You know, let them lead it. Give them the place. It's also about how you get stakeholders, you know, their buy-in. They need to have the discussion. You need to talk to them about the problem and then let them lead the solution. That's kind of the handshake that you have. It's very, very important to also to build good relationships between product and R&D, which, by the way, I'm very, very proud in what we have at Hunters in that sense. There's no, you know, chairs are not flying. People are not ducking for cover when PMs and R&D are talking.
So let's jump into Hunters a little bit and, you know, your newer role. I mean, you've been there for 2 years now.
Correct.
You kind of went from 0 to 1 with Imperva, Encapsula, and Exabeam. And then now I'm sure you're going from 1 to 100 being the VP of product at Hunters. So what is that transition like, going from individual contributor to like really running the show and being the visionary behind the product?
Yeah, so it's very interesting being, it's my first executive role, and there's it's multiple steps and phases into that, right? First, you know, I would say, shut up, listen, you know, don't use your mouth as much as you can, as much as they allow you. Listen, what's the problem? What am I not understanding? What should I hear? Just sat down with as many stakeholders as I could. Obviously, learn the product, learn the technology, learn a bit about how we do things. I knew the space because of my previous roles, but learn a bit about how we do things and what's working and what's not. And then identify how do we build a sustainable business? Meaning I'm not here to, you know, blow out specific fires. It's not a whack-a-mole. Okay, we have these processes that are missing in how we do development, meaning our roadmap at that phase, for example, was just a bunch of slides. Maybe you get them done in the time that you want, maybe not. It was kind of like guesstimating and hoping and really good job at praying, but not really you know, building, testing, measuring, executing. So we did a lot of changes around that. Really, me and my partner in crime, Yossi, our VP R&D, worked together. We hired Yossi shortly after. We wanted to drive a change in that organization as well and build a really agile motion where we're very predictable. Because we're a startup, we need to focus really hard, not be technocrats, not let the tail wag the dog. It's about execution. We have very aggressive plans, and I want to be able, when I talk to the company, when I talk to the board, when I talk to customers, this is going to happen in the end of the quarter. This is what we're planning for next quarter, and put that to rest. Otherwise, PMs just spin and cycle, figuring out what do I do now? What do I do now? This is not working. This is not working. And everybody's frustrating and trying to put out fires. I want to have an organization that knows how to operate. And then you can then you have the time to talk to customers and build strategy. What are we doing 9 months, 12 months, 18 months from now? Mm-hmm. Because what we're doing for the next 6 months is already kind of set. You come in, you tweak. A lot of organizations, they fail in that. They don't have the capability to, you know, go up for air. When you build the right team and the right processes, you're able to do that. And I think that's the big thing that I need to do and be able to delegate that. And then I had to build, you know, my organizations was, you know, about 2-3 people. It's now 10. I had to bring more product managers, put them in the right position, you know, assign them with the right team in the right area and build something that, you know, I can go on a vacation or go to tour with customers and everything. And the day-to-day is operating and I'm not needed for the day-to-day as much as possible. That was one of the, you know, big things, very different than what you do as an individual contributor, that executive role.
Before we hit record on the episode, you mentioned a word. You said the word zeitgeist. And I was like, what does that mean? And it sounded like you were saying that it's the popular thing today. Is that right?
It's the thing that it's in the current culture.
Current culture. That force that's moving everything forward. Mm-hmm. I would imagine, especially today, that thing is AI. What do we got to know about building products in AI today?
I think AI is this kind of almost like a dark horse, like something that just disrupts everything, right? It's just a force that came in. It's almost like, you know, global warming. It's like nobody asked you. Here's a force. Now you have to deal with it. And I think it's super interesting to look at, but I'm still trying to understand how it affects the now and then how it may affect the later. Meaning, we all want to use it today. A lot of times it's not in the maturity stage that we want it to be to do certain tasks. And then, you know, there's the saying, people overestimate the immediate improvement of things and underestimate the long-term change of things. So, okay, maybe it's not now, but in 2 years, it can be more than I can imagine, right? Like what happened, take 2 years ago, you know, what happened with GPT and what happens now, you would not have predicted this. So what can happen in 2 or 3 years? What does that mean for attackers? What does it mean for us? So I think now we're in this kind of limbo state where we kind of know where the technology is for the current future, for the current being. A lot of products are trying to integrate it, seeing that it works in some cases. That doesn't completely revolutionize security as of yet, but I think in 2 years, in 3 years, you know, we'll record the next episode. There'll be a whole different discussion. We'll look back and there's going to be some catalyst event to it. Right now, it's moving needles. We introduced it in our product. We're introducing it more different capabilities. It's not completely shifting everything. I think in 2 years, what we're trying to look now is where the vector is going, trying to understand what that means. Also from the attacker perspective, by the way. there's a lot of FUD out there. Oh, attackers are going to completely automate and completely do all these things. Sure. Maybe we need to see what that means from the protector perspective, from the defender. But for me as a business, I also want to make sure that they don't become obsolete overnight. So I think right now it's an interesting trend. We are observing it. Hasn't made the dramatic shift like it's doing, for example, in the realms of search and other areas that it can and probably will do in security.
Yeah, I think that with security on the attacker and defender side, I don't think we've really embraced it like we can. Like large language models, especially generative AI, I think could be really revolutionary to some tasks, like especially when you look at incident response, for example. I think large language models could really help incident response. If you have a war room, you know, you could have AI help synthesize that data and condense it down to something that's a little bit more manageable for your executive team to understand, or providing those automatic daily updates by looking at all the transcripts and the Slack responses and whatnot. And I've been embracing it as well. One thing that we do is we run all of our episodes through AI. We run all of our meetings through AI. We got a lot of Zapier automations that are connected. How have you been embracing AI in your world today?
So there's, I think the use cases that you outlined are very, very good. We looked at the technology when there was a breakthrough and, you know, everybody was like screaming and dreaming about ChatGPT and prompt dreaming. We did a hackathon. We actually sat down for a couple of days and Hunter's like, everybody needs to get a hands on this and think about how this is now a new mega tool in your tool chest to solve things. I gave two directives for the folks. Okay. One, it needs to solve a real problem. You know, everybody's trying to take a GPT LLM and stick it somewhere in the product. Are you solving a real problem, or are you just trying to be cool and get on the hype train? Because I'm not a big fan of hype trains. The second part is it needs to solve it in a way that makes sense for you to use this, right? Some things are best solved by an LLM, and some are not. An LLM, a prompt, or like a search, you know, omni search box doesn't replace a graph, doesn't replace some things that I can curate for you. Sometimes a drop down and clicking some checkboxes is a better user experience than show me all the things that this grouped by that and writing this very lengthy sentence. I'm just want to point and click. I don't want to type, right? So it needs to do that in the right way. So summarizing things, obviously it's amazing. Anything that's heavy text, analyzing, summarizing, using really eloquent and structured English is something that a lot of teams struggle with, because not all security operation teams are native English speakers, for example, something that we learned from discussing with our customers. So, you know, the fact that, you know, someone can help you even with the English is by itself something that's pretty good. And there's no a lot of tools that help with that. One of the cool things that we did, for example, is explain a command line. Right, there's a command line from this whatever thing in a log, and it's this very long list of flags and variables. Maybe they're concatenated, piped. You can't even Google that. You have to break it down and try to understand what it does. You either spend an hour trying to figure it out, ask someone, or you just like, I don't know what it does, right? GPT is uniquely amazing at it, as it knows the corpus of everything. It can dissect things. It's very structured, and it's very good at explaining things in the length that you want and providing you a structured answer. So we've introduced that into product, and our customers went like insane because it's like, oh, this is finally solved. It saves me so much time. Just click on it. Here you go. That's what it did. It tried to do. Could use this to change the credentials on that. And this flag means that it's not writing it to audit, blah, 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 blah. You can't, it's a real problem and there's no other way to solve it. So that's the way we approach it. There's been some things that we played with it that weren't really great with 3.5, And now with GPT-4 and the latest advancement, better context, less hallucinations, like summarize this for me. That's good, but it also adds liability and risk because you're actually asking it to do like lossy compression. Tell me what's important and what's not and draw conclusions for me. If I'm providing you that as a service, I want to be able to stand behind it. It was like 50, 60% quality for us, and that's a no-go. We want to get it to, you know, as good as a human or better so we can automate it.
Yeah, I've seen the same where, you know, one time you, when you enter a prompt in, it gives you this perfect answer back. And then the second time you do it, it's like, whoa, it's even better. But what about the fifth, sixth, the hundredth time? Is it that consistent? Even with, you know, the automations that I described, having our meetings transcribed, I used to have it also summarize the title. Like, hey, you know, Hunters in Hacker Valley. Mm-hmm. That's not very descriptive for someone that's reading this meeting. So I had to try to summarize the title of the descriptions just to provide more context. And the first few times it was great. And then I'm not sure if they updated their model or in the background or did some fine tuning on mm-hmm. their side, but all of a sudden, it started to be a little too eloquent, try to be so fancy and say, this is the meeting for Hunters in Hacker Valley to speak mm-hmm. about Ofer coming on the podcast and doing this. And I was like, whoa.
Using right, words like zeitgeist and all these fancy things.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm in love with AI, especially generative AI, but I think that we should be very cautious about one, what do we put in there? Because let's be honest, like I would use that information if I was OpenAI, Microsoft, Google to help train my models. And there's always that risk of it leaking. But yeah, you know, AI is great for use cases. And I think the general purpose, maybe we'll get there. I'm not quite sure when though.
Yeah, I think everybody's on the same page there. And in terms of training, by the way, the one of the things that we did is actually, yeah, use like a private instance. So the data is not being used. Our data that customers provide is not being used to train any model, and it's not shared between tenants, which was a big thing for us. So one of the engineers that worked on it says, listen, Ofer, setting up the APIs and whatnot was 10%. 90% was getting all the data privacy and stuff like ironed out. That was 90% of the project. So once you have that, you can start building more features on top of it.
I believe it. You know, there's a lot of people in our audience that, you know, work in cybersecurity that want to get better at providing solutions, whether it's working for a cybersecurity vendor or just creating solutions at their organization. If you were to give, you know, someone one piece of advice to be one step better at addressing the problem, what would that be?
Make it easier. Whatever you do, make it easier. Products that make it easier are the best products, right? You can make the most accurate, completely elaborate, customizable solution that nobody would use. And if you simplify the problem, you make decisions, you really make it easy for anybody to address the issue, then it's actually solving security. I learned that from my times in web application firewalls, right? The old school Imperva WAF or F5s and whatnot of the past, they were very, very advanced products that took years and years to configure. And a lot of customers didn't use them in blocking mode. They were only alerting them about things because if you block the wrong query on your website, you might lose money. And companies didn't want that. And Capsula came in, and because of the low-touch approach that it was built with, customers were using it in blocking mode. Did it have all the extensibility of these old products? No, but it was actually being used and it did an amazing job at it. So you don't compromise really on security and you make people actually use it. So that's, I think, for me, the most important thing when you build any product is to make sure as many users as possible can actually use it, especially in security because there's so much shelfware. So many products that were bought and they weren't implemented. I remember sitting at one customer said, you don't have a web application firewall now implemented? Yeah, of course we do. You see that box behind you? I kid you not, I'm not going to name the vendor. There it is, like the name of the vendor. That's the web application firewall. Nobody had the time to implement it. Same things happen in a lot of categories. And anytime you look into solving a problem, just make it easy. how can I make the person on the other hand, they're going to say, oh, so nice. That's the approach.
That's what it's all about. Make it easy. Sound advice. Ofer, thank you so much for spending some time out of your busy day to jump on the podcast with us. For anyone that wants to stay up to date with Ofer, be sure to check out the show notes or description wherever you're listening or watching. And with that, we will see everyone next time.